The Speaking of Cults podcast is presented solely for general informational, educational, and entertainment purposes. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from it is at the user's own risk. The views, information, or opinions expressed by the host and guests are solely those of the individuals involved and do not constitute medical or other professional advice. Hey, 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 everybody. Welcome to our special live midweek episode of Speaking of Cults podcast. And I can see I'm coming in loud and clear here, this live stream. I have done a lot of preparation for this because we did not do it on Saturday. And I apologize to anybody who was expecting the podcast on Saturday and wondering what happened. I just put it off because I thought, despite the fact that this is a podcast, which is an audio-only presentation for a lot of people, I wanted to do a, there was so much information packed into what we're going to be covering today that I wanted to do some visuals for it as well. And so I put together a PDF PowerPoint presentation. Maybe I'll even throw it up on my website or something if you're keen to download it or want to see all this stuff. But hey, I see all the folks in the comments here. And Boxing Guy Brian, by the way, I'm very glad you were able to join us live today as well. Always a fan of the channel here and show, friend of the show. And all the usual suspects in the comments here. So thanks for joining me for this. So this has been a show that I have been wanting to do for years. And I realized that with the coming end of my, you know, Scientology content, which really is a sort of a faux ending. I'll still be talking about Scientology all the time, I'm sure. But I won't be doing shows like this, where I take whole swaths of Scientology tech or writings or Hubbard's, you know, nonsensical ramblings, basically, and I break them down and sort of, you know, present them to you so you can get some idea of what Scientology is really all about and what its inner teachings really teach. And, of course, just offer my own, you know, personal experience with some of that. Other people had other experiences of their own with this, and there are no shortage of, you know, wild controversial ideas about there, even amongst ex-Scientologists, about the, let's say, veracity of this material and what it all sort of means. Let's go ahead and switch over to the host and chat screen there so we can get a little bit of chat up on the screen. We're going to be covering a lot of material today, so we probably won't have the chat up on the screen too much because I've, like I said, I've got this presentation to show. But no, Anthony, I thought you should watch my earlier, Anthony's asking a question in the chat. If good old Hubbard wanted Revolt in the Stars made into a movie, was he planning on declassifying OT3? Not sure why all the comments just disappeared like that all of a sudden. No, we did a whole show covering Revolt in the Stars. Revolting in the Stars, I think I called it. And I discussed in there the fact that that screenplay or treatment or adaption or whatever Hubbard, whatever word you want to use for that nonsensical, completely, anyway, it's really bad writing that Hubbard put together to make a movie out of that was going to be based on the OT3 story doesn't have the parts in it that would drive people crazy or make them sick or restimulate them. They had all that kind of taken out. There's no reference in that Revolt in the Stars screenplay or, like I said, write-up. Really shouldn't call it a screenplay. There's no reference to body thetans or spirituality or thetans or implanting or, you know, the any of that stuff. All of that is removed. Hubbard removed all of what he thought was was the restimulative, dangerous stuff. And he just wanted to sell the story of it as a story, as a science fiction story. So that's what that was about. All right, so let's go ahead and not turn this into a Q&A. I just saw that one question and thought I should bring it up. And yes, we are going to talk about the Espinol Confederacy. The intention of today's show is to cover all of it. All the science fiction, all the implants, all of the episodes, all of the goals, all the stuff you'll see. Put it in one place. Here it is. Here's all the Scientology science fiction madness. Now, there may have been one or two lines here or there that got missed here, but certainly today we are going to cover all the important things. Every phrase and weird thing you've ever heard about in Scientology, from the fly trap to the coffee grinder to OT3, Incident 1 and 2 with the little cherubs, and everything in between, we're going to talk about today. So I've done as best I know how to, certainly within a limited time period, right? I didn't have time to go through everything, but to put everything together so that we could get all of this in there. And you'll have to check that out, Anthony. It's a fun live stream, and kind of similar to what we're doing today. So let's go ahead and actually just get into it, okay? Let's switch over to this screen, and I'm going to, on my end here, I won't be seeing the comments and stuff. I'll check in from time to time because I am going to be full screen on this presentation. So here we go. Let's go ahead and get to it. The science fiction of Scientology. There is a tremendous amount of writing and lecturing that L. Ron Hubbard did where he described or dropped hints or implications of events that have happened to some of us or all of us in the far distant past, a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Hubbard doesn't talk about the future. Hubbard talks about the past and what's happened in the past. And here we go with that. He refers to it as space opera. And this was a term, I think, that came out of the pulps or around that time, having to do with science fiction or, you know, space fantasy type stories. The definition given in Scientology glossaries for space opera is, quote, of or relating to time periods millions of years ago, which concerned activities in this and other galaxies. Space opera has space travel, spaceships, spacemen, intergalactic travel, wars, conflicts, other beings, civilizations and societies, and other planets and galaxies. It is not fiction and concerns actual incidents and things that occurred on the whole track in the past. And I'm throwing a couple words around that we're going to define here. Scientology began in 1953 and has presented Hubbard's materials about space opera in different ways over the years. In 1958, for example, the church published a collection of quote-unquote case histories of Scientologists who had uncovered whole track memories as part of their auditing in a book titled Have You Lived Before This Life? This book stopped being printed after its last printing in 1990 and is no longer available as an official church property. Here are a couple of those, some quotes from those case histories that I thought you might find interesting from Have You Lived Before This Life? A past life as a robot working in a factory in space, which had gold animals hanging around it, which appeared solid but periodically imploded or exploded. It ground up discs to make small animals, which were then inflated after blowing up through a totem and a cat devil before being sent to other planets. A planet blew up and the robot was blamed. He was drugged and forced to work the grinder. All right. So that's one example of a Scientologist and the memories that he came up with in his auditing session or sessions from the far distant past. Here's another one, a past life that was 55, I don't know, trillion years ago, I'm guessing here. There's a lot of zeros, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There are 18 zeros after the 55. A past life, 55 trillion whatever years ago, in which the being had to do outside repairs on a spaceship. He suffered radiation burns and fell off, plunging into an ocean on the planet below. A manta ray killed him, and he in turn inhabited the manta ray. Then we have another one, a past life as a troublemaking free being on Mars, 476,600 years ago. He tried to inhabit a doll body, and those, a doll body would be similar to a robot body or a Terminator body, something like that. It's a mannequin-like device, not a human organic body. So he tried to inhabit a doll body, but he was captured and beaten up. The being was zapped with a ray gun by a Martian bishop in front of a congregation chanting, "God is love," before being run over by a large car and a steamroller. Apparently Mars is a pretty busy, dangerous place. He was then frozen in an ice cube and dropped on planet ZX-432, where he took another robot body and zapped and killed another robot. He took off in a flying saucer and died when it exploded. And finally, as far as the case histories here from Have You Lived Before This Life, we have this one, a past life in which a being went to a planet where the forces of good were fighting evil black magic forces. After 74,000 years of battle, implants, and hallucinations, he lost the fight and joined the black magic side. He went to another planet on a spaceship where he was deceived into a love affair with a robot decked out as a beautiful red-haired girl. All right, let me just fly over here and make sure we're not losing control in the comments here. Okay, good. So, yeah, this is some pretty wild stuff here. And to comment quickly on one thing, there was one place that I can recall, one or two places here, where L. Ron Hubbard made reference to magic being a real thing and that there had been magic universes where dragons and flying and wizards and things were real. So even that is sort of encapsulated into the Scientology dogma. All right. So science fiction as fact. Now, science, this is an actual quote here from L. Ron Hubbard's lecture from 1963 called The Heliotropous Implants, where he comments on the fact that science fiction is real. He says, now, science fiction writers following the cue of some chap, I've forgotten his name now, Einstein, Beinstein, something like that, who said that MC squared over C wouldn't go, man, and that the speed of light could not be excessive. And actually, I was looking up some speed tables the other day, and a trillion light years per day is not full throttle on a space wagon. So there's traffic between galaxies, and there's traffic between islands of galaxies and other islands of galaxies. Interesting. Has a lot, you say, well, this is science fiction. No. The only part of science fiction there are is the mistakes the science fiction writers have made while writing about their own past. They've made a lot of errors there. The truth of the case is that it has a lot to do with you as an auditor suddenly. Not that you have to embrace science fiction, but you have to look at this possibility. You've got to face up to the isness of the thing. So, of course, the translation here is that Hubbard is saying that these things are real and that science fiction writers and people who come up with this stuff are really just really pulling it from their own memories of their own, experiences in the past. And that is what science fiction really is, according to Hubbard. Now, the big picture of Scientology in terms of its beliefs, just to encapsulate this quickly for anybody who doesn't know, is basically as follows. The human spirit or soul in Scientology is an independent entity, a life unit called a thetan, which is a spiritual being and is not composed of matter or energy, and it has no real location in space or time. It simply is. Thetans created the universe trillions of years ago. In their original or quote-unquote native state, they were inherently capable of easily creating matter, energy, space, and time. Over the years, their awareness and abilities have dwindled to nothing due to the depravities and wrongdoings the Thetans have engaged in, such as wiping the air cover off an occupied planet or engaging in implanting. All right, now what are implants? Well, far back in time, Thetans who became too much of a nuisance or problem would be dealt with similarly to how ghosts are dealt with in the Ghostbuster movies, using electronic beams and traps to imprison them. This included Thetans who became rebellious towards the government or society they were in or around. Captured Thetans were then tortured and brainwashed to make them more tractable. There were many different ways this was done by many different societies over time, but no matter how it was done, the process of brainwashing a Thetan is called implanting. Now, we've mentioned a couple times this idea of the whole track, so let's clear that up. Now, in Dianetics and Scientology, the memories of one lifetime are referred to as a time track, using the analogy of a film reel to explain how memories are recorded and retrieved in a never-ending track of 3D pictures stored as sheets of energy in the mind. So when you refer to your memories from this lifetime, you are referring to your time track. The entire set of experiences recorded in the memory of a Thetan across his entire existence is called the whole track. Throughout Hubbard's writings, he described many key incidents on the whole track, which were shared by most or all Thetans on Earth and which served to impair their abilities and memories. All right, so let's just check in here. On the comments there, yeah, you guys are tracking on this. All right. So, history of implants. Now, I am not going to read all of these numbers here. I just wanted to give you guys a little breakdown of the sort of sequence of the key incidents that Hubbard describes in all of his various lectures. And you can see that amongst some of the oldest of these, or really the oldest one I could find, 70 trillion, 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 trillion years ago is the earliest implant named in Scientology. Now, I actually could not find a description of this implant, the story of creation implants. I just found this table of the list of all of them. And so 7 times 10 to the 85th power, that's how many years ago we're talking about, was this story of creation implants. Now, 40.7 trillion, 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 trillion years ago began a series of implants called the GLADE implants, G-L-A-D-E. And we are going to talk about those. And then 83 trillion, trillion, trillion years ago, we come to the Bear goals. And 110,000 trillion, trillion years ago, we come to the invisible picture goal. So you can see here, we're talking about orders of magnitude of time that are not just beyond, you know, modern science and the calculated age of our universe or all of creation. These are dates that go back farther than any person on Earth has ever contemplated anything happening or existing. We're talking very, very, very old dates. And Hubbard went on a roll all the time about how modern science had it completely wrong, not only on the speed of light, but on the very age of this universe and how long we as spiritual entities have been trolling around in this universe, inhabiting bodies and getting up to no good. You can see it, the list continues here when we get into the Helitrobus implants and gorilla goals and all these other things we're going to be talking about today. We're still back trillions of years ago. And then we finally get down more closer to Earth here when we get to 38 trillion years ago when Helitrobus fell apart, or 200,000 years ago when the Markab Confederacy was established, and finally in AD 1150 when the Espinal Confederacy finally abandoned our solar system. So this is the history of the universe, according to L. Ron Hubbard, as it really happened. All right, now let's go ahead and cover some of this. What we're going to do is we're going to cover first the various civilizations in space and societies and cultures out there, as broken down by L. Ron Hubbard over the years. He named a few different societies and cultures, and so let's go ahead and go through those. And after that, we will then go over the specific incidents that Hubbard describes happening in and across these various cultures. So the first one here, and this one is a little bit tongue-in-cheek. John Atack and I have had some laughs over this, because the name of this place is Arslicus, which could also be pronounced Arslicus, as in Ars Liquors. But Hubbard, of course, being the tongue-in-cheek guy that he was, anyway, this is Arslicus. Arslicus was an ancient civilization located in space rather than on a planet, as this was at a time when nobody had invented planets yet. See, Hubbard talks about different time periods on the whole track where planets didn't exist, gravity didn't exist, you know, various things hadn't come around yet. But the physical universe was still here in some fashion. Hubbard described it as being notorious for its mind-numbingly tedious jobs, putting Thetans to work for 10,000 lives in Arslicus, on the average, spent doing nothing better than polishing bricks. So they didn't have planets, but they had bricks. I don't know what they made the bricks out of if there was no planets to draw resources from, but, you know, Hubbard doesn't really ever have to address things like that. Arslicus was eventually ultimately destroyed when one of these slaves suddenly got the big idea of mass, and Arslicus broke to pieces and scattered around in that particular part of the sky as being of too great a mass to sustain itself. This was apparently about the point where you got the law of gravity coming in strongly. And after that, the law of gravity began to affect itself on the universe more and more and more and more, and you started to get all kinds of suns and planets and the most fantastic array of things. And this is L. Ron Hubbard, circa 1 December 1952, in the Philadelphia Doctorate Course lectures. So there is our first glimpse into Hubbard's description of an ancient alien civilization, and one that apparently a lot of us were slaves to all those years ago. All right. Then we come to the Espinal Confederacy. This is a lesser but apparently still extant alien civilization said by Hubbard to have lasted something on the order of a few hundred thousand years. It used to control Earth's solar system, which was Sun 12 of the Espinal United Stars. Their formal name is very long. It is the Espinal United Stars, or the Espinal United Moons, Planets, and Asteroids. This quarter of the universe is ours. The Espinals abandoned the solar system in AD 1150 when a group on Mars was finally abolished and vanished, and since then have used the system as a dumping ground for convicts. Yeah. So this is according to a couple of Hubbard lectures there, and you can see I sort of offered up a little bit of a graphic there of where Espinal might be represented compared to us. Okay. Then we come to the Galactic Confederacy, and you'll notice a very large laurel wreath and star symbol here on the screen, which is the symbol of the Sea Org, the Sea Organization, Hubbard's elite group of fanatics that keep Scientology going, which I used to be part of. The Galactic Confederacy, Hubbard says, ruled a broad swath of the galaxy and lasted for 80 trillion years. The Church of Scientology consciously models itself on aspects of the Galactic Confederacy. The Sea Org, an elite group within the Church of Scientology, has a laurel wreath logo said by Hubbard to be based on the symbol of the loyal officers within the Galactic Confederacy. Each of the leaves on the laurel wreath is said to represent one of the Galactic Confederacy's stars. According to the Dianetics and Scientology Technical Dictionary, the Sea Org symbol, adopted and used as the symbol of a Galactic Confederacy far back in the history of this sector, derives much of its power and authority from that association. And it's worth noting here, as you'll see elsewhere in today, that Hubbard believed that these symbols and icons and ideas from the past were not wholly and totally forgotten by Thetans in the here and now, and that these symbols and ideas could still have power and impinge on people and compel them to do things. Now, carrying on here with the Galactic Confederacy, the Church's own organizational structure, and you can see here the seven-division organizing board of Scientology, is said to be based on that of the Galactic Confederacy. The Church's org board is, quote, a refined board of an old galactic civilization. We applied Scientology to it and found why it eventually failed. It lacked a couple of departments, and that was enough to mess it all up. They lasted 80 trillion years. All right, so there's a little bit more to that story, but basically the long and short of it is Hubbard decided that he remembered this Galactic Confederacy of all these trillions of years ago and how they had sort of set themselves up, and he took a bunch of butcher paper and wrote down and drew a bunch of different models of how to design or set up an organization and settled on this one and said, yeah, this is stuff I'm remembering from, you know, long time ago. All right. Let's again check in over here, make sure all is well. Division 7 is in the wrong place, Liz, because it comes first since it's the executive division, and from it spring all the rest of the divisions. The divisions are put together in a flow or a sequence of how things are supposed to be produced or go flow through the organization. So it starts at the executive division as source and moves through communication, dissemination, treasury, production, qualifications, and the public-facing divisions, and that's why. Okay. So let us carry on here. Now, here we come to Helitrobus. And Helitrobus was a now-extinct interplanetary nation, which was only a little pipsqueak government, didn't amount to very much, Hubbard said. It was distinguished by gold crosses on their planes, like the American Red Cross or something of the sort. And you can see a picture here of an airplane with gold crosses on it. Despite their outwardly friendly aspect, the Helitrobans were responsible for a particularly vicious set of implants called the Heaven Implants, which were given some 43 trillion years ago. They were also responsible for implanting the Gorilla Goals, and we will be covering those later. The Himalayas were said by Hubbard to be the site of the defeat of the 3rd Battalion of the 5th Invader Force circa 6235 BC. We are now talking about invader forces. According to Hubbard, the solar system has been occupied repeatedly and sometimes concurrently by multiple invader forces. They were discussed in detail in a 1952 lecture, The Role of Earth, in which Hubbard described the conflict between the 4th invader force, which was already occupying the solar system, and the 5th invader force, which invaded without knowing that the 4th invader force was already in residence. And there are lectures here where Hubbard discusses the pyramids in Egypt being spaceports. and how there were battles between these invader forces in the deserts of Egypt, and how there were even Egyptian images and graphics of Egyptian people with laser guns. He said that you could see that in the hieroglyphics, which I thought was fascinating. Here we have the fifth invader force renamed the solar system, our solar system, as Space Station 33. But without suspecting that the fourth invader force had been there for God knows how many skillion years, had been sitting down, and they have their installations up on Mars, and they have a tremendous screened operation, meaning that there are force fields and electronics used to hide their presence and make them invisible. The result was a major clash between the two invader forces some 8,200 years ago in the Himalayas, when the 3rd Battalion of the 5th Invader Force landed about 72 miles northwest of the Khyber Pass and attempted to set up an implant station. And there's a picture there of the Khyber Frontier, pretty close to where Hubbard is talking about. The battalion was captured, taken to the 4th Invader's complex on Mars, brainwashed and stuck into human bodies. As for the remainder, the 5th Invader Force, out of its own protection, took over Venus. Oh, relatively in modern times, took over Venus and tried to stabilize the Venusians. If you called a 5th Invader, though, a Venusian, he would probably shoot you out of hand because it would be a horrible insult. They merely monitor the government of Venus, and they leave Mars strictly alone. Now, I am reading to you right now actual words uttered by L. Ron Hubbard in all seriousness in November 1952 in a lecture called The Role of Earth. And you can see the various Venus and Mars and whatnot. And we have sent rovers and orbiters and to investigate Venus and Mars, and we've landed on Mars. And there is no civilization, there is no government, there is nothing going on these planets. So I find this all absolutely fascinating. I hope you appreciate my picture here of a 5th Invader Force creature. I did use a little AI art for this presentation in putting some of these pictures together today. Now, here we're talking still about invader forces, and Hubbard goes over the fact that many present-day Thetans, you, me, and thee, are said to have been former members of the 5th Invader Force and can be distinguished by the fact that they believe themselves to be a very strange insect-like creature with unthinkably horrible hands. The Invader Forces are still said to be controlling installations in Mongolia, installations in the Pyrenees here on Earth, and there are installations down in the mountains of the moon in Africa, which pick up very often people on death. In other words, if you die, your Thetan, you, roam around to go find another body. But if you're roaming around Earth and you're not picking up another body, you might get sucked into one of these implant stations and get run through the mill that the 5th Invader Force set up in one of these places. You can get sucked right into it, get brainwashed, and get kicked out and end up in another body. You know, there you go, right here on Earth. All right. Just check back in here. Yeah, don't go into the light. Okay. Now we come to one of the most interesting and important of the alien civilizations, the Markab Confederacy. Now this is said to be one of the most powerful galactic civilizations still active. Hubbard describes it as, quote, various planets united into a very vast civilization, which has come forward up through the last 200,000 years, formed out of the fragments of earlier civilizations. In the last 10,000 years, they have gone on with a sort of decadent, kicked-in-the-head civilization that contains automobiles, business suits, fedora hats, telephones, spaceships, a civilization which looks almost an exact duplicate, but is worse off than the current U.S. civilization. Isn't that interesting? A civilization that is 200,000 years old, built on the fragments of older galactic civilizations, and they have fedora hats and 1950s-style telephones and spaceships and fire engines and various other things Hubbard talks about. So I just took a picture off of one of L. Ron Hubbard's fiction books as an example of what a Markabian might look like, according to L. Ron Hubbard's own description. So there you go. Now, the capital of this Markabian Confederacy is said to be one of the tail stars of the Big Dipper, probably Alcade, a star 108 light years distant from Earth. The Markabians used to rule Earth at some point in the past, but lost control of it due to losses in war and other things. And you can see there on the left of this little map here, Alcade, the final star there of the Big Dipper. The Markabians had an oppressive political system. If a person was considered to be in contempt of court or anything like that, he was simply fried, since there was a curtain of radioactive material which went clear across the front of the bench anywhere that a witness or anybody would stand, and so on. Now, apparently, they invented income tax as a means of punishment, with the death penalty imposed for making even the slightest mistake in your tax returns. One comma wrong, and it's dead forever. The Markabians also appear to have been distinctly socialistic, having had planned, balanced economies, which is presumably some form of planned economies, according to L. Ron Hubbard lectures that I've cited here. So, yeah, apparently taxes will get you anywhere and everywhere. Now, also, they were keen on motor racing, and every once in a while, Scientologists undergoing auditing, quote, will run into memories of racetracks and racetrack drivers, end quote. Hubbard described this in some detail in a 1960 lecture. He said, quote, they had turbine-generated cars that went about 275 miles an hour. They ran with a high whine. I noticed they've just now invented the motor again, and they had tracks that were booby-trapped with atom bombs, and they had side bypasses. The tracks were mined, and the grandstands were leaded paned. In other words, they were protected with lead panes. And here is a photo I found of an actual turbine car from 1954, which Hubbard was referring to when he says that they've recently just reinvented this turbine technology. Here's a couple other pictures of a more modern turbine car from 2019. And you can see the interior looks a little spaceship-like. Hubbard said that the tracks, these race tracks, were deliberately designed to be as dangerous as possible, with a mountain that you went up to the top of and fell off, and death was commonplace. However, Markabian medicine was so good that nobody ever died permanently. According to author Russell Miller, Hubbard liked to reminisce to his followers about how he was a race car driver in the Markab civilization. A Sea Org member later described Hubbard's stories of life with the Markabians. Quote, LRH said he was a race driver called the Green Dragon who set a speed record before he was killed in an accident. He came back in another lifetime as the Red Devil and beat his own record. Then came back and did it again as the Blue Streak. Finally, he realized all he was doing was breaking his own records and it was no game anymore. Now, there's some idea here in what Hubbard is talking about that the Markabians are aware of the fact that they are living life after life in these bodies, and so if they die, they just come back again. There's some awareness of this. And I struggle personally, among many, 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 many other facts that I'm going to give you today here from Hubbard's writings, I struggle greatly with the idea that any civilization would carry on for 200,000 years knowing that you do live forever and that they would somehow come up with a civilization with fire engines and fedora hats completely escapes me. I don't understand how you would create a civilization that would be in any way parallel to our civilization if we had that knowledge. Because if we did, everything would change immediately. Our civilization would be completely different. But Hubbard's not really a very deep thinker, you see. So I don't think he really considered the cultural or, you know, maybe anthropological ramifications of what he was talking about. All right, so Hubbard stated that the Markabian Confederacy was now using Earth as a prison planet. When a person's body dies, they as a Thetan are pulled into a Markab-established implant station or report station. The idea that Earth is a prison planet maintained by N-Theta beings, or Targs, as I guess they were named, who dumped their enemies on Earth, was first put forward in a 1952 lecture called Electropsychometric Scouting, Battle of the Universes. A steady flow of flying saucers is said to be still dropping off more N-Theta beings. Quote, the report area for most has been Mars. Some women report to stations elsewhere in the solar system. There are occasional incidents about Earth report stations. The report stations are protected by screens. The last report station on Earth was established in the Pyrenees. The Thetans are implanted and sent back to Earth, where they find a new body to inhabit. Some Scientologists who have reached a certain level of operating Thetan are said to be able to avoid this fate, but it's not exactly clear how. All right, so those are the key or the civilizations and aliens that Hubbard identified by name and described in some fashion. He never said that that's all that's out there. These are just examples of things that people have remembered from their auditing sessions that Hubbard glommed onto and decided to make into a cosmology. Excuse me one second. Now, here we see the list of all of the different incidents and implants that we're going to cover in some detail today. This is about everything I could find digging through the materials of Scientology and going online and finding some really excellent summaries of this stuff, which is I will credit at the end here. I'll tell you my sources on all this. So let's go over these key incidents here. And let me just check in here. All right. So here we have the aircraft door goals. Kind of funny name for something, right? But the aircraft door goals were implanted between 315 trillion years ago and 216 trillion years ago. Long-ass time. So like 100 trillion years they spent implanting people with this. Aboard the fuselage of an aircraft, with the Thetan held motionless in front of the aircraft door. Hubbard writes that the goal items were laid in with explosions. Now, the specific goals given in this implant were variants of the command to create. Okay, so let me clarify what he's talking about there. With implants, you have any number of commands that you can feed to a Thetan in order to control their future behavior and calm them down and get them under your spell. Literally. Implants tend to have commands that are very short and to the point. To create, to propagate, to die, to live, to steal, to, you know, these kinds of things. These are sort of intentions that are implanted in a person, and then they run around in the universe manifesting these intentions. So different goals, when they refer to goals here in the title Aircraft Door Goals, that refers to the goals that are implanted in the person because of this particular set of implants. Other implants would implant other goals, and we'll go over some of those. Excuse me. Like the gorilla goals. And the gorilla goals were a series of implants created by invaders from Hellatrobus between about 319 trillion years ago to about 256 trillion years ago. And I love the way that Hubbard combines these trillions. You just run out these numbers into, you know, 18, 20, 30 sets of zeros, right? to about 256 trillion trillion years ago, or 89 trillion trillion years ago, depending on which lecture you're listening to. It's very important we be precise about this, you see. But here's what they were. The gorilla goals were given, this is the quote, given in an amusement park with a single tunnel, a roller coaster, and a Ferris wheel. The symbol of a gorilla was always present in the place where the goal was given. Sometimes a large gorilla, black, was seen elsewhere than the park. A mechanical or a live gorilla was always seen in the park. This activity was conducted by the hoi polloi, a group of operators in meat body societies. They were typical carnival people. They let out concessions for these implant amusement parks. A pink striped white shirt with sleeve garters was the uniform of the hoi polloi. Such a figure often rode on the roller coaster cars. Monkeys were also used on the cars. Elephants sometimes formed part of the equipment. The hoi polloi used fantastic motion as well as blasts of raw electricity and explosions to brainwash the hapless Thetans into accepting the gorilla goals. The goals themselves were a series of simple tasks intended to trick the Thetans into limiting their inherent abilities, with the goals including to end, to be dead, to be asleep, to be solid, to be sexual, and so on. The black, okay, so those are your gorilla goals, all right? Yeah. All right, then we have black Thetan goals. And this is where we get to those glade implants. This is one of the this is the second oldest set of implants ever, anywhere. The black Thetan goals, also known as the glade implants, were implanted between 390 trillion trillion years to 370 trillion trillion years ago. According to Hubbard, they were in a glade surrounded by the stone heads of black Thetans who spat white energy at the trapped Thetan. The goals included such things as to end, to be dead, to be asleep, and so on. And you have a little AI-generated image of what that might have looked like. Then we have the bodybuilder incident. The bodybuilder incident took place around 50 million years ago, relatively recent compared to these other older ones. The Thetan was forced to fight again with his attention units and was generally tailored into a body, and that's all the description you get of it. Now, attention units in Scientology, it should be noted, are basically the way that a Thetan will put his attention on something is he will direct energy at it, run the energy over it, and receive, you know, sort of, I guess, in a sort of a sonar kind of, you know, you throw a beam of energy at something like a sound wave, and then it comes back, and you get the receipt of that, and that tells you something about the thing you've, you know, sonared. I suppose a Thetan is somewhat similar. Thetans don't run around blind. They can see or perceive however they want, but apparently attention units are how they basically put their attention on something. I used to think of attention units in Scientology as more of a metaphorical thing, but Hubbard does refer to it as an actual energy beam that a Thetan will generate. So I guess this was some sort of incident that involved building bodies. Okay, now we come to one of the most bizarre of the implant incident events, you could say, because Hubbard had a lot to say about this. We're talking here about bodies in pawn. Bodies in pawn result from an ancient, very gruesome experience in which, quote, a fellow is grabbed, hypnotized, shoved into an electronic field, and then told he is somewhere else. And so he departs, most of him, and goes to the new location while still being under control of the implanters. He picks up a messed physical body in the new location and starts living a life there. while still having a living body somewhere else. You got two bodies. The implanters can keep his original body alive indefinitely and control the Thetan through it. If the Thetan tries to flee, the hypnotizers simply cause pain to the original body, still alive in a vat of fluid, and he is immediately recalled. Thetan would be called back to the original body. Very similar to, and you can see the imagery I chose was from The Matrix, right? With these vats of fluid that bodies are stored in. That's a body in pawn. It's a second body you may have living somewhere else right in present time. But the second body is not under your direct control. They can apparently cause major problems for people undergoing medical operations as, quote, pain, an anesthetic, or a serious accident cause him to change to the other area with a shocking impact on the other body. The other body quite commonly dies or is deranged by the sudden impact. This gives the patient a repressed feeling of having died and leaves him very, very badly disturbed. Okay, so the idea there, if that's not clear, is that let's say you're undergoing heart surgery or you have an accident or something, and suddenly you as a Thetan bounce back to the other original body, and you're in such shock and there's so much like confusion, that body tips over and dies, and you come back to the body that's had the accident or surgery, and you're all shooken up by this whole thing. Yeah. Okay. That's bodies in pawn. Yeah. Okay. Now, Hubbard talks about, by the way, this lecture that Bodies in Pawn comes from is called The Role of Earth. And Hubbard talked about how this was used to maintain political control of an area, because you could take a leader figure and you could, you know, attach him to another body or arrange things so that somebody you control that way becomes a leader or the wife of a leader or something. And by controlling that person utterly and completely through this body and pawn operation, you would have and maintain political control of an area or military control or. So bodies in pawn was a super powerful control mechanism for civilizations and societies on the whole track. All right, let's just check in here. Well, I'm sorry, my microphone volume is low, but that's it's going to have to stay where it is because I've had other issues if I crank it up a little bit too far. Okay, but I will try to talk into the microphone a little better for you. All right. I'm sorry, your brain's hurting. Yeah, this is pretty wild stuff. And I'm giving it all to you in one go. Like I said, there's a lot here. And we're actually pretty far along, by the way. But this is all the sci-fi nonsense. And it's really a lot to sort through, isn't it? Right? Like Scientologists... Don't actually let me switch back over here to a second to the host and chat box for a second. All of this, you know, I've been describing, and lots of people who are ex-Scientologists will describe bits and pieces of this material over the years, right? We've talked about this stuff over and over and over again, and it is not really put together anywhere. And you've heard me say maybe over the years here how disparate it is, how like kind of all over the place, how there is not a unified cosmology of Scientology. All you get are bits and pieces dropped in this lecture or dropped in this other lecture or written about in this book in one sentence where he's talking about something completely different. And that's what you get, and you have to piece it all together. And so when you do piece it all together, like we're doing today, it presents this big picture of complete fluffery and nonsense. There's nothing really here. there's, you know, there's this sort of bizarre fact and this other fact that completely contradicts all known science and can't possibly be true. And then here's this other conjectural piece of information out of this other little bit. And you see, it's not really something Hubbard ever really put together as a coherent logical whole, because it never really served his purposes to do so. It was far better to keep people on tenterhooks, right? To keep people guessing and wondering, and how does that go with it? Oh, you'll get it all figured out on your next level. You just have to keep going up the bridge and it all sorts out. And you'll figure it all out for yourself, see? And that's kind of the experience of this in Scientology, is there's no one place or one time when you sit and sort all this out. It's not part of the bridge. It's not part of any course or class or auditing session that happened, that all of this be explained to you in one go. So that's one of the reasons why it can feel and be probably so confusing to everybody, is because it's just so random. But this is what it is. It adds confusion to the cocktail. Exactly. It keeps people guessing. And if you want to control people or manipulate people, that's where you want them. You don't want to be providing solid answers and certainty. You only want to present the appearance of certainty. It's quite a trick. Okay, so let's carry on here. So we come to the bubble gum or fly trap incident, and let's go back to the exhibits here. All right. So there's my little Phaeton in a bubble here. The bubble gum incident was an important early incident where you are hit with emotion and finally develop an obsession about motion. It was the first incident on the time track which included words. Here it is, first time that we have words. Quote, very, very early on the track, a long time before the present populace came into being, there was a theta trap called the fly trap. It was of a gummy material, also called the bubble gum incident, because every time a thetan pushes against it, it pushes back, and it finally gives him an obsession about motion. All right. Then we come to the bear goals. The bear goals were very similar to the gorilla goals, except that instead of a mechanical gorilla, a mechanical or live bear was used, and the motion was even more violent. They were implanted by, quote, a group called, I think, the Brothers of the Bear, and were the ancestors of the hoi polloi, which we referred to earlier. All right, so that's from a 1963 bulletin from Hubbard. And maybe that's one of the mechanical gorillas or bears right there. Okay, then we come to the heaven implants, which were actually one of the more controversial bits of Scientology lore ever leaked out of the church. The heaven implants, and I am not even going to try to read that date, but the heaven implants were given 43... what is that? Trillion years? 344 days, 10 hours, 20 minutes, and 40 seconds from 10:02 and a half p.m. daylight Greenwich time, May 9th, 1963. So Hubbard decided at one point that it was really important to date down to the second when things happened. If you could get the precise location and the precise date of an incident, it vanishes. Goes away out of your memory, all the trauma is gone, and you don't have to worry about it anymore. It blows. The charge connected with it, the mental charge connected with it, goes away, which is why we see such a precise date here. Quote, they comprised two series of views of heaven, the first of which was quite positive. Hubbard compares heaven to Busch Gardens in Pasadena, California. In the second series, heaven had become a lot shabbier. Quote, the place is shabby. The vegetation is gone. The pillars are scruffy. The saints have vanished. So have the angels. A sign on one, the left, as you enter, says, this is heaven. The right has a sign, hell, with an arrow, and inside the grounds, one can see the excavations like archaeological diggings with raw terraces that lead to hell. Hubbard reported that he had encountered no devils or Satans. Heaven was, however, not quite as conventionally depicted and took the form of a town, which, quote, consisted of a trolley bus, some building fronts, sidewalks, train tracks, a boarding house, a bistro in a basement where there is a bulletin board well lighted, and a bank building, end quote. Hubbard described how the second series of heaven implants depicts, quote, a passenger getting on a trolley bus, a workman halfway down the first stairs of to forget, eating lunch, and in to be in heaven. And this is the quote. It doesn't make grammatical sense. I'm doing the best I can with it. A gardener or electrician adjusting an implant box behind a hedge and periodically leaping up and screaming. So that, I actually fed that into an AI art program, and that's the photo I got. And I went, you know, good enough. That's heaven. So after being ridiculed in the Anderson Report, which was an Australian public inquiry into Scientology, this particular bulletin of May 11th, 1963, was withdrawn from circulation and no longer forms part of the publicly admitted Scientology doctrine. And it has been gone. That's not that that bulletin is not in the modern technical volumes of Scientology. So so that is heaven for you. Yeah. All right. Then we come to the other famous implants in Scientology that are talked about more, maybe a little bit more often than some others, the Helitrobus implants. And like OT3, this one is particularly funny because it is all based on a gross misunderstanding that L. Ron Hubbard had of science and astronomy. The Helitrobus implants were implanted by the inhabitants of the planet Helitrobus some 382 trillion years ago to 52 trillion years ago. The Helitrobans were motivated by a fear of free Thetans and sought to restrain them by capturing and brainwashing Thetans in order to weaken them. In a series of lectures, Hubbard goes into some detail about how this was done. Quote, planets were surrounded suddenly by radioactive cloud masses, and very often, a long time before the planet came under attack from these implant people, waves of radioactive clouds, Magellanic clouds, black and gray, would sweep over and engulf the planet, and it would be living in an atmosphere of radioactivity which was highly antipathetic to the living beings, bodies, plants, anything else that was on this planet. And so planetary systems would become engulfed in radioactive masses, gray and black. And the earmarks of such a planetary action was gray and black, gray towering masses of clouds. These Magellanic clouds would not otherwise have come anywhere near a planetary system. Now that's the quote from State of OT lecture given in the 1960s as part of the St. Hill Special Briefing Course. But get this. Magellanic clouds are in fact dwarf galaxies orbiting our own Milky Way and are not clouds at all. Hubbard was talking complete gibberish. Magellanic, there's a large Magellanic cloud, there's a small Magellanic cloud, there's a picture of the small one in 2013. This is its own little galaxy that's orbiting ours. And they don't come in on a planet and give it gray and black clouds of radioactivity. It's just a gross misuse of a term that Hubbard's trying to, as he did so many times in so many ways, trying to make himself sound way smarter than he really was and way more informed than he really was, and he ends up with egg on his face because he's misusing these concepts and terms out of astronomy. But there's more. When a planet had been engulfed, the heliotropes would attack it with little orange-colored bombs that would talk. And the clouds themselves would talk. And here you'd have a quote, and here you'd have a gray cloud going by, and it'd be saying, "Hark, hark, hark, you see? Watch out, look out, who's there, who's that?" I mean, admittedly, it would be a little weird if clouds started talking. I will give him that. Hapless people on the planet's surface would be kidnapped using a small capsule, quote, placed at will in space. It shot out a large bubble. The being would grab at the bubble or strike at it and be sucked at once into the capsule. Then the capsule would be retracted into an aircraft. A victim would then be implanted for up to 6 months, and the heliotropes would, quote, fix him on a post in a big bunch of stuff, put him on a post, and wobbled him around and ran him through this implant of goals on a little mono wheel pole trap, and it had the effigy of a body on it. Okay, so I guess it looks something like that. And that's your heliotropes implants. Yeah, good stuff, huh? All right, let's just, like I said, check back in with everybody here. Oh, yes, he was absolutely ahead of his time. All right, now we come to the invisible picture goals. These were implanted by an early race of alien implanters sometime between 110,000 trillion trillion years ago or earlier to 390 trillion trillion years ago. This is old, old stuff. This is amongst some of the oldest stuff. They comprised brainwashing of captive thetans by showing them pictures of diametrically opposed goals, such as wake, never wake, sleep, never sleep, as well as invisible pictures to confuse the thetan. Now, I don't know about you, but I actually can't conceive of an invisible picture. The entire concept of it eludes me. Maybe it makes more sense to you guys. The other pictures would consist usually of a scene of a cave, a railway, an airplane, a view of a sun, and planets, as you can see here in that picture. Not quite invisible. Then we come, all right, now, of course, we cannot not mention, because I did say everything. So, of course, we're going to have OT3 and the whole Xenu narrative in here. And I'm not going to describe all of the Xenu stuff. You guys are already well familiar with it, or you can go watch South Park. It's all in there. Oh, this reminds me, I meant to put on here a little band that says this is what Scientologists actually believe. Because let me tell you something right now, more Scientologists are aware of this stuff than they are of Xenu. The implants and the bear goals and all this other stuff is actually not confidential material for the most part. Any Scientologist has access to most of this material in the book History of Man or the other basic books and lectures that are not confidential. When we come to OT3, this is highly confidential. I'm reading you very, very sacred scripture here. So there's incident at OT3, by the way, the level of OT3 contains two narratives, two incidents. Incident two is the Xenu story, but incident one is this first thing. And this is supposed to literally represent the entry of all of us, Thetans, into the physical universe for the first time. It is set 4 quadrillion years ago, and an unsuspecting Thetan was subjected to a loud snapping noise, followed by a flood of luminescence, then saw a chariot followed by a trumpeting cherub. After a loud set of snaps, the Thetan was overwhelmed by darkness. This is the implant opening the gateway to the present universe, separating Thetans from their static, natural, godlike state, And this is part of OT3 given in 1967. So there's our oh-so-humble beginnings in this universe right there. Then we have the R6 implants, which is the incident 2 of OT3. This is the work of the Galactic Confederacy's tyrannical leader, Xenu, 75 million years ago. According to Hubbard, Xenu destroyed billions of captured subjects during Incident 2 by dropping them into volcanoes and attacking them with nuclear weapons. The subjects, once disembodied, were forced to watch a 3D super colossal motion picture for 36 days. This implanted pictures containing God, the devil, angels, space opera, theaters, helicopters, a constant spinning, a spinning dancer, trains, and various scenes very like modern England in 1967, I guess. So, yeah. So that's your second half of OT3. All right, now we get the train goals. This is devised by the Markab invasion force and implemented between hundreds of years ago to hundreds of thousands of years ago. So this is relatively recent stuff. The train goals were a series of implants given in a huge train station. The Thetan was put into a railway carriage, quite like a British railway coach, with compartments, and subjected to a barrage of white energy. During the implant sequence, a quote, a face may come up and say, "You still here? Get out. Get off this train. We hate you." And from the speakers, "This happened to you yesterday, tomorrow, now. This is your departure point. Keep coming back. You'll be meeting all your friends here. When you're killed and dead, keep coming back. You haven't a chance to get away. You've got to report in. This happened to you days ago, weeks ago, years ago. You don't know when this happened to you. We hate you. Get out. Don't ever come back." Pretty pleasant, right? So that's the brainchild of the Markabians messing with people between lives by using British railway coaches. Yeah, no wonder trains are so unpopular, huh? All right. Then we have, let me just check back over here. Okay. All right. And then we have this before Earth and before MEST, before matter, energy, space, and time. There is a before Earth and a before MEST universe in all banks and basically in our minds. The incidents are not dissimilar. They consist of the preclear being summoned before a council, being frowned down, being sent elsewhere than where he was. The council's intent is to reduce the person downscale in order to get a more obedient colonist. And I guess you can see that represented there. So, yeah, apparently this is something we all have in common, which would drive our fear. Hubbard would absolutely insist. If you've ever had a fear of speaking in front of people or being called on the carpet or being nervous in front of people, it would all come from your before Earth incidents here. All right, then we have the coffee grinder. Hubbard gave the name the coffee grinder to the messed aspect of the Fourth Invader Forces, FAC-1. Okay, FAC-1 is facsimile 1. This was the title given to one of the first implants that Hubbard ever wrote down or documented, which is why it was called facsimile 1. And he termed it an outright control mechanism invented to cut down rebel raids on invader installations. So, you know, Hubbard's ideas almost from day one on these implants is that you would use brainwashing and mental psychological control of spiritual beings to keep them in line and keep them under control. And this coffee grinder was one such method of doing this. It was originally laid down in this galaxy about a million years ago and consists of a two-handled portable machine which, when turned, emits a heavy push-pull electronic wave in a series of stuttering baps. The invader gratuitously left these machines around for the yokels. Believing that the treatment was vital to get to heaven or some such thing, the yokels practiced on each other, found new victims, and generally spread the implant around. So that's your coffee grinder is just one of, you know, thousands of these things. And then we go to the ice cube incident. And there were many, 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 many of these. This is a little bit of a Xenu-like story in which alien invaders and flying saucers plant living entities. Here's the quote from it from Hubbard. Here is an intriguing incident, which if your preclear demands, should be audited. This is evidently a method of transportation of beings to a new area. The being is packed in ice, is taken to the new area, and is usually dumped in the ocean. Your preclear, if he has this one in restimulation, has very cold hands and feet chronically. Hubbard also notes the new crew in the area is later quite surprised to find that their planted beings, so carefully dumped in the sea from a saucer, are being picked up between lives and given treatment by an old established invader whose methods of political control are long since established. So just the back and forth of invader forces here, but this is your ice cube incident. And this one is often commented on as rather silly. But silliness clearly never stopped Hubbard from his writings about this subject. Then we come to the jack-in-the-box. According to Hubbard, here we have an invader trick, a method of trapping Thetans, wherein the alien invaders trick the Thetans into gathering an endless loop of facsimile pictures and confusing themselves, ultimately ending in an explosion. Hubbard warns auditors, you will find a preclear with this in restimulation to be very curious about cereal boxes, which have pictures of cereal boxes, which have pictures of cereal boxes. I can't help but be amused by the timeliness of all of these, how Hubbard wrote all this in the 60s and 50s and thought his best representation of a modern take on ancient spacefaring civilizations is going to be compare it to modern Earth. I find that so weird, but Hubbard does that over and over again. You see, you notice that? He really didn't have much in the way of imagination for being the big sci-fi writer that he claimed to be, did he? I mean, if you really think about it, there's really hardly anything original in any of Hubbard's sci-fi writings or in any of this. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty humdrum stuff. Okay. Finally, oh, I did not change the photo on this one. I am sorry about that one. I missed on the obscene dog. I am so sorry that I missed on that one. But you know, let's go ahead and pull up what that is so I can at least describe it to you because it's pretty wild stuff. The obscene dog was a sort of a brass dog in a sitting position, and anybody who got around to the front of the dog got caught in some electronic current and passed through the dog to the dog's rear end and spat out. Yeah, that's yeah, that's pretty wild. Apparently, it takes place after Incident 1. It's just a little bit later than Incident 1. So here you are getting snap, crackled, and popped into the physical universe with a cherub and a chariot. And then, not too long after that, you're roaming around as a Thetan in black space, I guess, because gravity hasn't been invented yet and planets haven't been invented yet and Arcticus isn't around yet. So what do you do? Hey, what's that over there? Why, that's a little brass dog. What's that doing here? Well, let me go take a look at it. Whoa! You get sucked into this thing and tossed out the back end. Apparently, Thetans didn't like this. Yeah, no shit. All right, so that is that. And those I left on screen there, you can see my sources for all of this. And I especially want to thank fandom.com because and the Wikipedia articles, because whoever put that stuff together did some really, really excellent work on this and really saved me an awful lot of time in putting this together. Because that was one of the things that actually had prevented this show from happening for so long is I didn't want to have to go through all of the library and compile all this crap. You can see there's tons of it, and it's from lots of different sources, and including a lot of lectures. And I didn't want to have to go through all that. Well, I didn't have to. I found it sort of summated for me, and then I kind of combined and put things together, and there you go. So... yeah, that's where the expression "he's got balls of steel" came from. That's right. Guy's got some brass balls. All right. So, oh, I didn't mention trains on Venus. Oh, I am so sorry. I thought going over the fact that there were civilizations and implant stations on Venus and Mars would be encapsulating of that. But no, yeah, Hubbard talked about taking a train ride on Venus. Like I said, there are lines here and there that Hubbard talked about I didn't necessarily dive into. But yeah, he definitely talked about that and talked about how, you know, there were implant stations on Mars as well and, you know, all these things that are just complete hokum and nonsense. But there you go. I think that covers pretty much all of it. That is your sort of tour guide, your guided tour of Scientology's cosmology. As far as I'm concerned, it's a one and done. This is basically everything there is. This isn't everything that Scientologists have ever imagined has happened to them. As I read to you at the very beginning of this, those case histories from Have You Ever Lived Before This Life were quite imaginative, some of them even a little bit more imaginative than this other nonsense from Hubbard. And I personally imagined and created all sorts of things that happened to me personally in the whole track, on the whole track. I imagined in that 1,000 hours of false purpose rundown auditing that I got on the RPF, I ran incidents having to do with not pulling the air cover off of a planet, but igniting the air cover on a planet. Instant incineration of everything there. I had other incidents of things, all kinds of crap, right? And so have other people. I think I've probably forgotten more than I can remember, to be honest with you. But I wanted to just sort of put there what did Hubbard lay out for people? What's the templates? What are the models that Hubbard offered for people for what they could then take and run with for their own auditing sessions, you see? And I think you can see here in this wide range of implants and goals and alien civilizations, you can see that there's really, it's kind of a no-holds-barred kind of situation. Anything goes. And when you add magic and wizards and dragons to it, which Hubbard alluded to here and there, then really there is no memory that is too outrageous, too outlandish, or too unreal to have considered as real in Scientology. And this is why anything goes there. Anything. So that's kind of the big picture of it all. All right. I hope. Technique 80. Yeah. There were a couple early techniques that L. Ron Hubbard described in Scientology, Technique 80 and Technique 88. This is 1951, 52 material. And I one time tried to actually go through the lectures and through the bulletins and actually list out what these techniques are and how you would do them. And they were very indistinct. It was very, very difficult to actually figure out what are the commands, what is the sequence, what am I trying to do with this? It was very, very loosey-goosey, very, very unspecific, and I remember being very frustrated about that. All right, so that all sort of happening now, I guess we're going to sort of wrap up our live stream. This was the podcast I wanted to do today. I want to thank all of you for coming around and watching me go through this live. And thank you for your input and your questions. It helped me put the show here together, which is exactly why I wanted to do this, is I wanted to see what your feedback was like as we were going. And make sure that if there was anything I wasn't clarifying that I should, that I got a chance to do that. So there you go. Yeah. I'm really glad, Polar Vortex, that I have gotten you off the fence. Okay. On that happy note, I will see you guys live here on Friday for our Critical Conversation show. And we'll figure out a podcast for this weekend as well, and carry on as usual. So with that, goodbye, everybody.